Today is Monday, August 16th. I'm Bradley Pepping, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Good evening, and thanks for joining us. Whilst enjoying this astonishing heat, maybe you were rocking the grooves of justice. Yesterday, CITR ran live coverage of the third annual Justice Rocks Festival. Hosted by Pivot Legal Society, the festival was held in Strathcona Park in an effort to create social change through music. This year's event was grounded with some of Vancouver's pillars of activism and was interspersed with live musical acts. On today's show, we'll bring you some highlights of the activism from this music festival, and we'll address why justice rocks and how it fits into a music concert. Later on the show, we'll bring you this week's edition of Groundwire, news from Canadian campuses and community radio stations. On this week's program, we'll hear stories from across the country that range from oil spill cleanup, residential schools, and the impacts of mining in Canada. And of course, today's show wouldn't be complete without our regular weekly segments, including a peek at the most recent headline from thetie.ca, the online news publication. That's all here on News 101 in the next hour, your source for volunteer-produced community and campus news. And to start things off, we'll go to our friends at Free Speech Radio News for a look at this week's international headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Kashmir, protests continue despite strict curfew conditions across much of the region. In Srinagar, a number of protesters were hurt in clashes with security troops. And in the north, demonstrators set fire to offices of pro-Indian officials. The death toll in recent months has climbed to 57. Two more youth died over the weekend as a result of police action. And in India, opposition parties forced both houses of parliament to adjourn in protest today after police killed two farmers in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. Bismillah Gilani reports.
Farmers in the state have been protesting for the last 3 days, demanding increased compensation for their land, which the government has appropriated to build a road. The protests turned violent on Sunday after police arrested a protest leader. Two farmers died. Opposition members described the police action as outrageous and frequently disrupted house proceedings today, demanding action against the Uttar Pradesh state government. While the government has ordered an inquiry into the killings, the situation in the area remains tense, with thousands of farmers taking to the streets for the fourth day today. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
According to a spokesperson for the Israeli military, soldiers shot and killed an Islamic Jihad fighter today. The IDF says that they identified a group planting explosives along the barrier fence and opened fire. One soldier was also injured. Over the weekend, Israel's defense minister approved the purchase of 20 fighter jets that can avoid radar detection. The stealth F-35 jet is manufactured in the U.S. by Lockheed Martin and is the most advanced combat jet to date. The $2.75 billion deal will be paid for with funds provided by the U.S. through military aid. Israel will be the first Middle Eastern nation to add this new fighter plane of the future to its weaponry, which some analysts say could allow the Israeli Air Force to launch unanticipated preemptive strikes in the region. The first batch of jets will not be delivered until 2015. The head of a Somali media group today called for the release of a journalist jailed for broadcasting an interview with a militia leader, Abdul Karim Jamale reports.
The director of our said media radio station was arrested last Friday after airing an interview with Al-Shabaab linked militia leader Mohammed Said Atam, who is on a UN Security Council watch list. Just one day later, a court in a semi-autonomous state of Puntland sentenced Abdelfitah Jama Mire to 6 years in jail and a fine of $500. The senior prosecutor told the court that the journalist propagated the views of the militant leader, who is waging war against the government. However, the radio station's management vowed to appeal the verdict, calling it undue. The National Union of Somali Journalists called the sentence a steady encouragement on media freedom and independence. The broadcast of the interview coincided with fighting between Atam's militia and Puntland forces, during which several fighters and soldiers died. Puntland declared regional autonomy under federal Somalia in 1998 and has been relatively stable since. The region has a functioning government with a civil service and elections, and its own security forces. Abdul Karim Jamale, FSRN.
Human Rights Watch issued a report today on the violence in Kyrgyzstan last June. They say that the attacks on ethnic Uzbek neighborhoods, during which at least 370 people died, were made possible by government forces and that security forces did not adequately protect the community. Further, the rights organization says that subsequent government investigations into the events have been rife with abuse and that ethnically motivated attacks continue. Witnesses report that security officials removed barricades blocking off Uzbek neighborhoods, allowing rampaging mobs to get into the community. The human rights group also says that questions remain as to whether government forces actively engaged in the attacks and called for an international probe. American Lori Berenson was back in a Peruvian court today. Prosecutors seek to revoke her parole, saying the decision to release her was, quote, riddled with errors. Berenson served 15 years of a 20-year prison sentence on terrorism charges. She apologized today for any harm her presence in Peru may have caused the country, but continued to deny being a member of the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement. While she has admitted collaborating with the group, she says she did not participate in any violent acts. The court now has 15 days to consider its decision. And in Afghanistan's Kunduz province, a young couple were marched into a field yesterday with their hands bound behind their backs and stoned to death. The death sentence was ordered by the Taliban under Sharia law. The pair was accused of adultery. 20-year-old Sadiqa was stoned to death first. 28-year-old Kayum was shot when he didn't die quickly enough. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
As always, we'd like to thank FSRN for making those headlines available to us. And if you'd like to catch the daily news report from Free Speech Radio News, check out their website, fsrn.org. Now, the Tai.ca is the independent daily online magazine that reaches every corner of BC and beyond. Today, we're happy to be joined on the phone by Jeff Dimbicki. And Jeff is joining us today to chat about an article of his recently published on the Tai.ca about oil sand workers in northern Alberta. So first off, thanks so much for coming on to tell us a little bit about your article, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Maybe we could start off if you could give us maybe some context about this article. So we know how great the Tai covers the oil sands and their daily activities, but here you look at the personal side of the tar sands. So tell us a little bit about this article, Oil Sand Workers Don't Cry.
Well, basically, there was a sociology student from the University of Alberta, and she became fascinated by the idea of what actually goes on in the personal lives of oil sands workers near Fort McMurray. There's a shadow population of 25,000, and they're called shadows, essentially, because they live in work camps outside Fort McMurray. Not much is known about these people. There's lots of rumors. They're painted as social deviants. We know that there's lots of drug and alcohol abuse going on, but very little research actually done. And so this sociology student has been interviewing oil sands workers and addictions counselors and labor experts for the past few years. And this story does a summary of what she found.
And so I guess a great point to start off as where she found is the ways in which, as you say, they're painted as deviants, but it's hard to try to get to the roots of maybe why people are engaging in those types of deviant behaviors like coke or meth or ecstasy addictions. And one of the quotes that I wanted to highlight from the article was how it seemed a lot like the Fort McMurray and people working up in the tar sands are working in a prison, in that every single action that they take that they do is controlled, and they feel like they're part of a cog, or they're a cog in a machine. Maybe you could tell us about kind of the ways in which what's going on in their daily activities trickle down to some of the things that lead to deviant behavior.
Yeah, well, the lifestyle is very difficult. A lot of these workers come from far away. They come from as far as Newfoundland, actually, some of them. And so that means friends and family, traditional social support networks are just lacking, and they're so far away as to not even appear real. We're talking work camps that are little more than 8-foot by 8-foot rooms in long trailers. And for a good part of the year in Fort McMurray, it's minus 30 or below. So you're isolated physically, but also isolated from the outdoors because these frigid temperatures just make any time outside completely unbearable. And in this context, you also have work camps that are patrolled by teams of security guards that, according to some of the people this sociologist interviewed, are just intent on enforcing every tiny rule, just power tripping on oil sands workers. And since many of these people are above 35, they feel patronized. They feel like they're just mere cogs in this oil producing machine.
And yet, and so you say that a lot of the power tripping happens to these people. But I think it's important maybe here to note that 92% of these 25,000 workers are actually men. The 92% of the population up there is male. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about how this sociology student talked about, or how, I guess how you labeled it, the Marlboro man with the muskeg, how these men were kind of playing with gender and masculinity.
Yeah, one of the interesting angles of this study is its use of gender studies to examine issues of masculinity. Traditionally, gender studies have focused on the role of women in social networks or as part of a larger economy. So this sociology student from the University of Alberta has posited this idea of rural masculine ideals. And so in northern Alberta, she compared the ideal masculine man to the Marlboro man, except he's wearing a hard hat and he's working in the muskeg. And to be masculine in northern Alberta, you have to be self-sufficient, you have to be tough, you don't worry about getting help for your problems, you don't cry, and you're basically invincible, as this sociologist said. And these ideals really permeate worker life in northern Alberta.
And so I guess that ties into a lot of kind of what she was talking about when she's addressing the different people that she spoke to, and how there was the drug abuse or alcohol abuse was rampant. However, the people accessing counseling services was dismal. And whereas, you know, there are so many problems, maybe what you could tell us now is about, it is quite remarkable, as you say, that, you know, it's gender studies and within the discipline of gender studies, being able to examine men and being able to examine the rural man and how that manifests in this type of environment. But what can you tell us about the impact of this study and about the impact of your article? What's going to be happening with putting a face to all these, or putting a personal face to all these people working up north?
I mean, it's impossible to say what sort of impact the story will actually have, but I know for myself, I grew up in Alberta, and on the weekend, oil sands workers would come into town, they'd get wasted, they'd beat up cops, no joke, actually. And these people just didn't seem on the same level as people in other occupations. They did seem like deviants, but what I find most interesting about this study is that a lot of the aggressive behavior, the drug use, the alcohol abuse, is in fact related to the vulnerability that a lot of these workers feel about being far from friends and family, about being trapped in these prison-like conditions, and about not feeling important in the workplace.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for bringing us this story. Maybe you have a final last words or something that you're working on in the future that we could look to on the Ta'id, upcoming piece of yours?
Yeah, I actually visited Fort McMurray in early July, and there's going to be a three-part series about my trip down there. So that's coming out next Monday, I believe, on the Ta'i.
Great. Well, thanks so much again for speaking with us today, and we'll make sure that we do jump over to the Ta'i to check out those articles next week.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
That was Jeff Dembecki of theta'i.ca. And to read his article about the tar sand workers in northern Alberta, jump over to theta'i.ca, and that's theta'i.ca. We're going to take a brief break now for some public service announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from the organizers and supporters of this past weekend's Justice Rocks Festival, a music fest hosted by Pivot Legal Society to inspire social change through music. To hear how justice is love and love is justice, stay tuned to CITR News right here on CITR 101.9, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in a very sweltering Vancouver.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces. All in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education, every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
CITR 101.9 FM is proud to support the 22nd annual Vancouver Queer Film Festival from August 12th to 22nd. It's Vancouver's second largest film festival, and every year the Queer Film Fest brings the very best in queer independent cinema from around the world to Vancouver. On top of all the great films, the festival also hosts performances, workshops, panel discussions, and parties. Be sure to check out CITR's sponsored screening of Riot Act, Flaunting Gender Deviance in Music Performance, on Tuesday, August 17th at 9:30 at Cinemark Tinseltown. Don't miss the Vancouver Queer Film Festival from August 12th to 22nd. For more information, go to citr.ca or queerfilmfestival.ca.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 at CITR 101.9 FM. You're either listening to us broadcasting live from your radio, or you are listening to our podcast, or you're streaming us online at CITR.ca. We're now going to turn our attention to this weekend's Justice Rocks Festival, hosted yesterday by Pivot Legal Society in Strathcona Park, downtown Vancouver. The third annual event is an opportunity for Vancouver's activist community to get together and listen to some music, dialogue about politics, and engage with some common social issues. So we have a few clips of different interviews that we had on our CITR yesterday. We were live streaming from the grounds, and we had some great interviews with some of the people behind the event and who are also supporting it and who are also just taking part. And so first we're going to jump over to the evolution of the event. And I think that it's really great the way that CITR reporter Matt was able to address how this event came about. He was speaking with Pivot Legal Society Executive Director John Richardson, and they go through how Pivot Legal Society started, some of the things that Pivot Legal Society does, and why an event like this is important. So first off, here's Matt in conversation with John Richardson.
John, first, before we talk about the festival, can we go way back to the genesis of it all, Pivot Legal Society? Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Well, Pivot started about 10 years ago, and it basically emerged out of desire to assist the residents of downtown Eastside in a way that was really capable of addressing the root causes of some of the issues there. So we were a bunch of lawyers, and we thought about how can we use the law really strategically to advance the interests of marginalized people. So we began a number of campaigns in downtown Eastside around housing, police accountability, law reform for sex workers, aiming to change policies and set precedents to really have a broad impact and affect many people.
That's right, and we've actually recorded an interview today with Aham Johar about the housing campaign, the Red Tent campaign. That's been sort of a main campaign for this year. I wonder if you could fill us in on a little bit more detail about some of the other campaigns, like the sex work campaign,
sure,
for instance.
Yeah. Well, sex work campaign is one of our primary campaigns, and it's about asserting rights for sex workers in that kind of time and across all of Canada, actually, because the perspective that David brings to the issue is that the criminalization of sex workers further marginalizes and dehumanizes them. And in fact, although many of the ideas behind criminalization of prostitution, that it harms women, we're sympathetic to, but the actual process of criminalization and how it impacts sex workers actually reduces their quality of life even more and marginalizes and criminalizes them and prevents them from actually seeking, in many cases, the support that they need. So Pivot's position is that we need to decriminalize sex workers and work really hard to bring them into a state of empowerment.
Mm. And you've had support in the community from other groups as well, from downtown Eastside, for this ongoing campaign?
We have, and we've done, we have a test case in the courts right now. We're challenging the criminal code provisions of the criminal code provisions that make it illegal or criminal for sex workers to work at all.
Right. Wow. So this is quite pivotal. This is groundbreaking.
Yeah.
Test case.
Yeah. That's right.
And globally, other countries, have they succeeded in these steps prior to this?
It's a very divided debate. But yes, there are countries that have taken steps towards the regulation of sex work. New Zealand is, the one that we hold up as the kind of purest example. And they are making great progress. And there has been a real step forward in New Zealand around rights for sex workers.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's brilliant. That's some cutting-edge litigation here that Pivot Legal Society is engaged with. Another issue, of course, is the housing campaign, and there's been investigations into SROs, the single room occupancy, how can you comment on the Red Tent campaign and where that's headed at the moment?
Sure. Well, I'm not sure if your listeners know much about the Red Tent campaign.
A little bit detail. Just, I guess, more the genesis. We didn't talk too much about how it came about here.
Right. Well, it's initiated in France a number of years ago. There was a campaign in France to increase the rights of people to have housing, and they used Red Tents as a symbol, and it was a very powerful campaign. It actually had a big impact and resulted in commitments by the French government to increase funding for housing and also commitment, which has not yet been realized, to entrench housing as a right in the French Constitution.
Hmm.
So we looked at that campaign and saw, you know, the very many aspects of what made it so successful. It's very visible, it has a strong message, and we decided to bring that to Canada.
Hmm.
So many people saw the Red Tents through the Olympics, and that campaign has continued. We did a demonstration in front of one of the Conservative MPs' offices just a week ago, lobbying for the federal government to enact a national housing strategy. And that is due to go before the federal parliament on October 20th. And so Pivot, along with a number of other national organizations, are doing actions across the country leading up to a grand action on Parliament Hill in October.
That's right. And listeners, in the next couple of hours, can hear more about this very important campaign when we talk to Aham Johar. I wanted to sort of inform listeners a bit more about just how innovative Pivot Legal Society actually is in terms of its day-to-day work and how the regular nuts and bolts work of lawyers and the income that's used can actually fund really interesting strategic litigation and a genuine social movement. It's very innovative, and I wondered how the vision is being sustained and your steps into the future and you think it might look.
Well, we're continuing on our campaigns right now. As you know, we have the Red Tent campaign. And we have our housing campaign, policing campaign, sex work, child protection, etc. And we continue to push forward. We're, you know, initiating events like Justice Rocks. We've also created a nonprofit law firm called Pivot Legal LLP, whose purpose is to sell legal services and use the revenue from those services to further fund the campaigns of society. But always with a focus, I should say, on strategic litigation. So Pivot's reason for being was never to be a clinic, a legal clinic, although we do some of that type of work. The broader purpose is to really find those test cases that have the potential, if they win, to affect a broad number of people by challenging laws or policies that affect a large number of people. So we're always on the lookout for opportunities in that way to find those cases that with properly litigated can really advance the interests of marginalized people.
That's right. And there's a lot of history of support here in the local community from also organizations like the BCCLA, and David Eby, of course, has had history at Pivot. So it really is a strong movement that's been built here.
Right.
And that leads us actually to what we see here today, which is genuine mobilization of the community.
Right.
And you must be very proud to look at this, another year on and see it unfolding with more and more people. Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of Justice Rocks specifically? How many years has this been going for?
This is third year now. And the idea behind the event, so, you know, people that are not here, I'm looking around right now and I'm seeing about 15 different tents hosted by nonprofit organizations, and all of them are actually in a competition right now, competing with each other for the votes of people that are attending. There's the people going around collecting ballots from people about which organization is the most innovative and effective and engaging the public. So we're really trying to encourage the nonprofit community to find new ways, new creative ways of engaging with people, getting them talking, getting them thinking about social change, and also building a community between these organizations. We have organizations talking to each other here in ways that they've never really connected before, social justice organizations, environmental organizations, youth organizations, you know, all sorts of social change organizations are here today, and really knowing that the world is not going to change unless all these people whose hearts are so dedicated to making the world a better place are starting to work together really in all sorts of different ways, and also start to connect to the broader community in a way that's different from traditional ways that nonprofits have done it. Often when we come to these issues with real concern or dismay about how the world is right now, and with some negativity around that, and you need that negativity in order to really go to the heart of things and challenge them. But if you're going to make social change into a mass movement, there's got to be more than that. To the joy and celebration and happiness, and that is what will bring people into a community of social change. So that's what we're trying to do here with Justice Rocks. We have musicians, we have performers, we have art. It's just an absolutely awesome and fun day. And so trying to mix that with kind of the vision and the motivation for making the world a better place and bring a whole bunch of new people in and propel them forward in looking to make the world a better place.
That's right. It's definitely, it's inclusive. The sense that you have here is anyone of any age can get involved in something here today, feel part of something. I'm myself a former intern at Pivot and had a remarkable experience, and I noticed that just the people you see on a day-to-day basis in the office is the tip of an iceberg. There's a lot of people in this city who are doing all sorts of things I have no idea about, and they're here, and so it's quite amazing. And then on that note, are you aware of anything else of this magnitude in North America that is doing a similar thing? It seems like you really are breaking ground here.
Well, I think Under the Volcano was a very long-standing and respectable event, but we're trying to do, I think, something a little bit different from the Volcano here, which is really appeal to a broader mainstream audience. I think the vision here is that social change is not going to happen unless we get everybody working for that. Right? And sometimes it's easy to develop a message and like a communication strategy that's about talking to people that are already believing in what you're
doing.
But by bringing in great DJs like we have today and great bands and the vending stalls and all these wonderful things, we bring in people for other types of reasons.
They
have a fun day, and then peripherally they have these experiences of social change, and they think, oh, that'd be interesting, that's something I can really connect with. And so it's about really trying to tap into and realize a greater movement.
That was Matthew Grenland speaking to Pivot Legal Society Executive Director John Richardson about this weekend's Justice Rocks Music Festival. And with that interview, we're going to close our show. We'll leave you today with this week's edition of Groundwire, news produced from campus and community radio stations across Canada. And that'll be a half-an-hour segment this week, focusing on stories from residential schools, oil spill cleanups, as well as the mining industry in Canada. And that will be the end of News 101 for Monday, August 16th. Again, I'm Bradley Pepink, and today's show was produced by our news director, Andrew Longhurst. News 101 is a volunteer-produced and volunteer-run alternative campus news program, and we run every Monday during the summer, and we look forward to offering you 2 hours of programming during the school year, Mondays and Fridays, from 5 to 6 p.m. This show will be podcast, so you can check it out at CITR.ca, and make sure that you follow us on Twitter and Facebook with the username CITR News. Again, we're going to be leaving you with Groundwire, and at 6 p.m., make sure that you stay tuned for Career Fast Track. This is CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building in Vancouver, British Columbia.
This is Groundwire Community Radio News from coast to coast to coast.
Anybody who wants halal meals or anything like that is not being provided with that, and vegetarians or vegans are not getting their proper meals.
That in this country we're really seeing that shift toward more extensive use of police powers, state-sanctioned use of police violence against peaceful people.
Making profit from incarcerating people is wrong.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Jennifer, hosting from CHRY 105.5 FM in Toronto.
In this edition, features on prisoner justice. But first, the headlines. In campus news this week, University of Victoria is the latest campus to grapple with the status of pro-life student groups. Ashley Gaudry has this report.
The UVic Student Union has recently been in a legal battle with the pro-life group Youth Protecting Youth. The student union revoked the group's club status because of student complaints of offensive posters titled Feminists for Life. After which Youth Protecting Youth launched a lawsuit with the BC Supreme Court. The BC Civil Liberties Association has supported the pro-life group's right to club status, with Dr. John Dixon declaring as of July 19th that this settlement is unacceptable. The student union has now reinstated Youth Protecting Youth despite campus opposition from other student groups and has returned the group's funding, which, according to the Canadian University Press, is over $700. In this article, it was also said that the student union harassment policies directed at pro-life groups were also removed. The student union's chairperson, James Cockola, stated that the settlement was important financially, as they would have spent much greater amount of money in court defending themselves. I spoke with the president, Anastasia Pierce, about who is supporting Youth Protecting Youth.
Majority of our members are Christian and Catholic, but we do have people who are not religious. And we are obviously open to anyone who's interested in joining.
I also spoke with Brittany Harris of the Women's Center at Simon Fraser University about financial support for pro-life campus groups.
I would say most of the funding is from Catholic organizations and evangelical Christian organizations. I would say it's pretty religious and it's pretty Christian. There's a lot of money that is being put into these organizations. Pro-choice organizations don't get the same amount of funding. They also don't get government backing, and pro-life organizations do.
For Groundwire, this is Ashley Jean Gaudry reporting from Burnaby, BC.
Thanks to CJSF for that, with files from the Canadian University Press.
BC has a surge in university-educated immigrants, but has a chronic shortage of doctors. The BC Association for Foreign Trained Medical Doctors wants this to change and has renewed efforts for policy change. Here's Jennifer Morrow from CJSF with more.
The head of a group for foreign physicians is saying more needs to be done to ease British Columbia's doctor shortage. Patrick Cody is executive director at the Association of International Medical Doctors of BC. And while more physicians are calling the province home, Cody says BC is still in catch-up mode. He says the more internationally trained physicians or Canadian doctors we can graduate, the faster we'll be able to tackle the chronic shortage. The College of Physicians and Surgeons of BC reported 488 new doctors registered in 2009. That's more than double the previous year's increase. The jump is attributed to more graduates coming out of medical school since the provincial government doubled the number of seats in 2007. A new labor mobility law also helped. Now doctors can move to the province without having to requalify. But according to the BC Medical Association, 250,000 British Columbians do not have a family doctor. BC needs 400 new physicians each year just to maintain the status quo, yet there are only 256 medical school seats. That's where the association says foreign trained doctors can help. Cody says there are hundreds of international medical graduates that have to redo their residencies because their credentials are not recognized in BC. At St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver, there are only 18 residency positions a year for foreign-trained doctors. Cody says we need a combination of more residency seats for foreigners and a program that helps them get trained and licensed sooner. Jennifer Moreau reporting for CJSF in Burnaby.
Last month, on the 21st of July, a violent altercation between two inmates turned into a tragic fire that provoked the death of two people. According to Eric Bailil, who works for the group de défense des droits des détenus de Québec, because of the fight between two people, guardians punished the whole prison sector. Prisoners reacted to this by starting a fire. Emergency crews were called in and the detainees were asked to evacuate the wing, but eight people refused to comply. This event highlights the situation of prisoners who too often put their lives at risk as a way to protest against their conditions. Eric Bailil, the Groupe de défense des droits des détenus de Québec spokesperson, continues condemning the terrible conditions prisoners suffer. Quote, "It is a shame that we have to wait for such a tragic event for the media to react. Nowadays, the main problem is that the detainees don't trust in the system any longer. They refuse to file complaints, and the last means that remains for us it is to put their lives in danger. There are a lot of organizations that raise this issue, but the government doesn't seem to want to do anything. And unfortunately, prisoner conditions are not a subject which interests public opinion." End quote.
In Toronto, inmates of a Scarborough Detention Center held a hunger strike over poor nutrition and lack of exercise. As of airtime, the hunger strike that began August 9th continues.
Lisa is someone who has heard about these conditions inside the jail firsthand. Her boyfriend has been detained there since May.
Well, all the prisoners, I believe there's 476 of them, have gone on the hunger strike. I knew a couple days before that they were going to do it. Well, they're really sick of just being treated like animals. I think their main concern was food and health care. Apparently, it's really hard for them to see a doctor, and if they get transferred in from another jail, their medications take about a month to 2 months to follow them. Anybody who wants halal meals or anything like that is not being provided with that, and vegetarians or vegans are not getting their proper meals. The prisoners that work in the kitchen are alleging that the guards are actually removing their meat. Yeah, and as far as I know, they were prepared to do it for as long as possible. They didn't really have a date in mind where they're going to start eating again. They were going to try to go as long as humanly possible.
Toronto has come under criticism this year for three deaths in custody at the Don Jail and a number of complaints filed against the G20 Detention Center. Additionally, in the Greater Toronto area in 2009, the Roy McMurtry Youth Center came under fire for denying blankets, insulin, and other items to youth detained there. Back to Groundwire Community Radio News. That was music by Ashkan Habuti. On August 9th, communities across Canada held demonstrations and workshops for Prison Justice Day. Prison Justice Day came about after the deaths of two prisoners at Millhaven Prison in Kingston, Ontario. Prison guards have deactivated the emergency call buttons in the solitary cells, resulting in the bleeding death of Eddie Nalin on August 10, 1974. 2 years later, the call buttons had not been reconnected, and Bobby Landers died after leaving a written description of the symptoms of a heart attack. In Winnipeg, the Elizabeth Fry Society held a walk to raise awareness for incarcerated women. In Montreal, Prison Justice Day was remembered with a public commemoration ceremony on the front lawn of the Sudbury Jail, and a noise demo was held. Here are the sounds of more events held in Halifax and Vancouver.
I'd like to start by acknowledging that we're on Coast Salish territory. It's really important for us to be here and to hold this rally here today. We're also at the location of the Claire Culhane Memorial Bench, and that's an important location for us to be. Claire's bench is here because of the work of prisoners that she's helped over the years. And for us, it's a place to come. It's a place to remember the struggle, to remember the work, and to remember the people inside.
More on like just a personal sort of level, just the idea of prisons as some sort of way to condition people is just insane, right? Like, it's been proven like over and over again that that sort of system doesn't work. And more so, like, it's definitely just a way for the state to, you know, well, not only keep control over the population, but also to make a lot of money off of people.
In the provincial institution, when we're arrested, or when we're sentenced and we're let go, we're given a bus ticket back to the place where we were. So every time that we were released, we were given bus tickets back to where we did crime with a welfare check. So here you are, here's a bus ticket, and here's some money. And not a lot of money, not a lot of money to get an apartment or anything, or get a place, but enough to get high on.
The volume, the second volume of Words Without Walls, which is a zine that Works Beyond Bars produces, that compiles writing and artwork by women who are incarcerated in Nova Scotia, and tries to connect people, connect those stories and what those women have to say to a wider audience, as well as you know, give them the confidence, or like, as well as provide them a space to say things that they would otherwise not have a medium to say them in.
And now to our features this week. As Stockwell Diggs continues to argue that Canada has a pressing need for new prisons, the federal government and Corrections Canada are quietly dismantling Canada's prison farms. Prison farms enable inmates to gain valuable work skills while contributing to local agriculture. The budget cuts will lead to the shutdown of 6 prison farms. A rally against the cuts was held in Kingston, Ontario on August 10th. Advocates say they support the prisoner farm program for many reasons, saying that it provides a way to enact restorative justice and increase Canadian food security. Annabelle Koo has more.
Hundreds of people gathered for a 2-day protest on August 9th and 10th, Prison Justice Day. In their latest action to save Canada's last 6 prison farms, supporters gathered to try to block trucks removing the cattle from the Frontenac Prison Farm in Kingston. Eric McBay, an organizer with the Save Our Prison Farms campaign, explains.
So 4 empty trucks arrived around 2 in the afternoon. There were 500 people there, and we refused to move. So we stopped the trucks. The police threatened to arrest everyone, but, you know, they simply didn't have the capacity to arrest that number of people who were engaging in peaceful civil disobedience. So they started to arrest some people at random. The people who were arrested were ranging in age from 14 to 87. So, you know, that really tells you about the broad demographics that support the prison farms.
Among this broad demographic are local farmers concerned about losing the benefits prison farms offer for future employment and food security in Canada. Jeff Peters, organizer with Save Our Prison Farms.
When you put down agriculture the way they have done it in this issue, rural Canada will remember that, because farming is basically the cornerstone of rural Canada.
Meanwhile, Diane Dowling, an organic dairy farmer and campaign organizer, adds that prison farms play an equally important role in prisoner rehabilitation.
The prison farm is probably one of their best rehabilitation and training programs that they have. Corrections always has a lot of trouble setting up employment arrangements for the inmates, because it has to be able to be taught and done within the prison, and then it also can't really compete with outside private business and so on. And here's a program that, you know, successfully was changing people's attitudes and also producing food for the system. So it was a good program. Why change it? And we've never been able to get what we consider it to be a common sense kind of answer for why they were getting rid of it.
Another major concern underlying the campaign is the government's steady passing of so-called tough-on-crime policies, coupled with state-sanctioned police brutality towards those who speak out against them. Eric McBay speaks to the police violence he witnessed at the Frontenac prison protest.
This policy that they've chosen today is kind of reflective of the broader policy of the Harper government in general, in that there's not a lot of subtlety, and that their approach is really, rather than try to negotiate or engage, is basically to try to bully people around and try to bully communities into doing what they want. Mm-hmm. And that's what we saw here. You know, the Kingston support was very strong, so they had to bring in these people from out of town to use violence to disperse protesters. I think they were very aggressive, unnecessarily so. I think people who are, you know, law-abiding citizens have lost a lot of respect for them today. Regular people lost a lot of respect for them today. It was clear by the constant honking of people driving by in their cars that there was, you know, huge support. And, you know, these regular people driving by saw their neighbors getting dragged off by these aggressive police who were striking people and shoving them to the ground. So I think, you know, this is totally unacceptable action to use this kind of violence on peaceful protesters. And this, you know, this is one of the reasons that the prison farm campaign has gained so much traction, is that in this country we're really seeing that shift toward more extensive use of police powers, you know, state-sanctioned use of police violence against peaceful people. And so, you know, here we are protesting against a government that's using violence to put people in jail unnecessarily, and they respond by, you know, using violence and arresting protesters to put them in jail unnecessarily.
Bridget Doherty of the Sisters of Providence warns.
As we got involved, we started to learn more about correctional policies and the direction our current government is taking us in. And we've also learned a lot about the people who are taking Canada into this direction. There's Robert Sampson. He brought the private super jail to Penetanguishene. There's a document ironically called the Roadmap to Strengthening Public Safety. But it's not going to lead to safer communities. In fact, it's going to lead to more crime in our communities. So it's very sad that they're bin mastering like this. But Robert Sampson brought the private super jail to Penetanguishene, which failed on every indicator. He is now looking at super prisons in the United States and at public-private partnerships. So it'll be public money and private profit. And America is working hard at getting away, in fact, from that system, because making profit from incarcerating people is wrong. You know, you need a market for anything that you want to make profit on. And you see now with the changes in the 2-for-1 legislation that was introduced in February that now we are going to get the increase in inmates.
The cattle trucks did eventually leave the Frontenac prison farm, but the movement for healthy rural communities and prisoner justice continues to build.
In the next few days and the next week, we're going to regroup and, you know, this was the last line of defense for the prison farm here, but it's also the first line of defense in new struggles, the struggle against the development of that land, the struggle against the construction of a new mega prison there. And I think that, you know, people who are arrested today, they were in high spirits.
I heard several people say, I've never been involved in anything like this before, but I heard about it and I asked for the day off today at work and I decided to join you because this is about more than just the prison farms. It's about democracy.
For Grand Wire, I'm Annabelle Koo, reporting from CHRY in Toronto with files from Elamin Abdul Mahmoud and Emily Aspinwall.
To the West Coast now, where a downtown women's group protests this week, claiming their children have been removed from their custody unfairly. The correctional system plays a role here, they say, since in recent years, BC and other provinces have been quietly cutting programs that allow women to keep their children with them while incarcerated. Those children often end up in foster care. Grand Wire updates a 2008 report on mothers in prison.
Last week, women from Vancouver's downtown Eastside demonstrated at the Ministry of Child and Family Development. The Downtown Eastside Power of Women group organized the demonstration to bring attention to the removal of children from their families and what they believe is the targeting of poor and Indigenous women. The group says that the ministry removes children of low-income and First Nations families at a rate that is disproportionately high. There are currently more First Nations children in the child welfare system than there ever were in the residential school system. Amidst this backdrop, the BC government is also withdrawing support for mother and child units in its prisons. Canada had mother and baby units in a number of provincial institutions and six federal prisons, allowing inmates to bond with very young children. However, in 2008, BC began canceling its mother and baby programs at Alouette Correction Center and the Fraser Valley Penitentiary. Since then, other provinces have also canceled their programs to integrate mothers and babies in prison, including Manitoba and Alberta. Tiffany Chong of Stark Raven Radio interviewed many of the women involved with mothers and baby program in the Fraser Valley. First, we hear from Patricia Block, a woman who gave birth while incarcerated.
2 days before my delivery date, I was told that I was not accepted into the mother-child program. I'm still perplexed as to what the actual reason is, as to why I was not accepted into the program. I had the Ministry of Children and Families stating that the institution wasn't supporting me, and then I had the institution stating that the Ministry of Children and Families weren't supporting me. So in the end, the baby was born, and there was no time. We were separated. My first opportunity in court following my release, she was returned to me. They could have kept us together. There's a suit that's being filed against the warden of ACCW, the Solicitor General of British Columbia, and the Attorney General of British Columbia. It's basically asking for the program at Alouette Correctional Center to be reinstated and that mothers be able to keep their children with them in the institution. And I guess there's some charter issues that, you know, the cancellation of the program had no regard for the rights of the mother and child to remain together following birth.
Patricia Block's lawsuit is still in progress. In Vancouver, the Downtown Eastside Power of Women group say they need more support services so the children of poor and marginalized mothers are not targeted for separation, whether in prison or outside. A U.S.-based study on mothers in prison found that mothers separated from their children had a 34% rate of recidivism versus just 9% for women who kept their children with them. Christine Hemingway is a former inmate who assisted the mother and baby program and now works to research women's issues in prison. She says the data is clear. Women who care for their children while incarcerated are less likely to reoffend.
The women would come in and sign in and they see me with the baby and it would make their day. It would light up their faces. They'd come back on their breaks and come around the baby and then start talking about their children. It would open them up. Whereas if the babies weren't there, I don't think the subject would ever come up. The reason why they say they canceled the program is because the guards don't have the proper training to facilitate the program. But also one of the main reasons why they canceled the program, my personal feelings, is it's a budget cut. The government are saying it's a safety issue. I was at ACCW for 17 months and was a babysitter for one of the babies. And for the whole time I was there, I never saw any issue, any violence around the children whatsoever.
first informal prison nursery in Canada was started at the Provincial Portage Jail in Portage La Prairie, Manitoba, in the mid-1970s. The Correctional Service of Canada formally implemented its program in 2001 at six federal prisons. These programs are now under scrutiny by the Federal Public Safety Ministry. Although Corrections Canada maintains that the programs have never been officially cancelled, there are currently only two babies with their mothers in federal prisons. For Groundwire, this is Gretchen King with original interviews by Tiffany Chong of Vancouver Co-op Radio.
On last week's Community Radio Report, there was great excitement about the historic funding decision released by the CRTC, bringing over $700,000 to community radios in Canada. This week, we examine some of the finer points of the new CRTC policy on campus and community radio.
With all the excitement of the community radio sector's historic and forthcoming funding of over $700,000, you could be forgiven for overlooking the other details of the CRTC's new policy. The policy review has also eliminated the difference between Type A, or small market radios, and Type B, larger market stations. Now all campus and community radio stations will have the same conditions of license. Under the former regulatory policy, Type A stations had to ensure that 15% of their weekly content was spoken word, and Type B stations had to air at least 25% spoken word. The CRTC has now agreed with the National Community Radio Association recommendation to harmonize the spoken word content requirements for both stations to 15%. The Commission also increased the Canadian content requirements for Category 2 music, that covers pop music such as rock, and Category 3 music, covering special interest music such as folk, world beat, or jazz. In its decision Thursday, the Commission increased those minimum Canadian content requirements to 40% for Category 2 music and 15% for Category 3 music. Groundwire spoke with former NCRA Board President Charlotte Bourne, Frida Weirden from CJSF Burnaby, and John Harris Stevenson of openmedia.ca.
So my name's Charlotte Bourne. One thing that needs to be recognized is the difficulty that the CRTC actually had in trying to construct a policy that's relevant to the entire sector, because we are so diverse. You have small stations that are in rural areas that have no paid staff at all and are only operating on volunteers. And then on the flip side, you'll have larger stations, say campus stations in urban environments. There's also a bit of a difference between English language stations and French language stations. The English language stations tend to be more dependent on, say, donations or perhaps fees from campus students. Whereas if you're dealing with a French station, they tend to have more resources from the provincial and national governments, and then they also are more reliant on advertising. So they've also got very different financial realities. The campus community policy had some tighter regulations, so we've just gone to one sort of looser regulatory environment for everyone, and by looser I mean more flexible. So giving smaller stations the ability to program maybe more in line with what they're actually doing rather than trying to adhere to a regulatory environment that's almost infeasible for them to meet.
My name is John Harris Stevenson, and I'm a longtime community broadcaster. There would be situations in the past where community radio was mandated to do certain kinds of programming, even though people in the community didn't want to see it. It wasn't relevant to them. And that aspect of things has changed significantly. But we're now dealing with a single campus and community radio policy environment. It's very important for the campus broadcasters that they're now recognized as a community service, and they have many of the same requirements as community radio has had in the past.
One CRTC commissioner, Mark Patron, wrote a dissenting opinion of the CRTC's decisions, saying he's concerned it opens community radio up to greater commercialization. Quote, "My concern, based on submissions made during this proceeding, is that community radio may gradually become something more akin to a commercial venture. There is some evidence suggesting this is already happening," Patron wrote. Patron also took issue with the lowering of spoken word requirements, saying, quote, "The higher requirement of 25% recognized the need for Type B stations to be distinct from private commercial stations operating in the same market," end quote.
For an urban campus station, who maybe has a news department, it's easier to produce news. But if you're a rural station and you are required to produce 25% spoken word, which was what the previous requirement was, it's really, really onerous. And you may at times find yourself in violation of CRTC policy. So the The point of reducing spoken word requirements wasn't to say, hey, you should be doing less spoken word. It was to be more conscious of the realities of some of those smaller stations in the sector.
This is Frieda Worden at CJSF-FM in Burnaby, B.C. As a spoken word coordinator, I'm mainly interested in the change in the spoken word requirement, which is being reduced from 25% to 15%, but that 15% has to be locally produced. Our station already has about 20% of our airtime in locally produced spoken word, so we shouldn't have any problem meeting the 15% requirement when our license comes up for renewal. However, as someone who has worked a lot to promote program sharing among and between stations in our sector, I'm disappointed to see any incentive for carrying community radio syndicated programs disappear. I don't think spoken word quotas are the main reason that stations choose to air Groundwire or the National Homelessness Marathon or Canadian Voices or Deconstructing Dinner or my program Wings Women's International News Gathering Service to